given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up.
Welcome to Illuminations. I'm Renee Moran, and I'm joined by my co-host, Deanne Phillips.
This is a show about people making ripples in the spirit sphere in the 21st century. From ancient history to modern-day innovations, we are unpacking the stories of all kinds of interesting subjects, people, and events. We're going to the very soul of the matter, and we're bringing it to you.
Thank you for joining Illuminations today. Hello, I'm Deanne Phillips. I'm your host. And today we're joined by two gentlemen I've been looking forward to having on this show. They are the Bible Project founders, Dr. Tim Mackey and Jonathan Collins. The Bible Project is a crowd-funded free educational resource on the Bible with all kinds of features and millions of followers worldwide. Welcome, Tim and John.
Hi.
Hey, Deanne. Good to talk with you. Again.
Thank you. Okay, can you start us out by briefly giving us kind of an overview of what the Bible Project is?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. Well, Tim and I, about 7 years ago, were hanging out. Tim had just come back from Madison, Wisconsin, where he was had just gotten his PhD and was working there, moved back to Portland, and I had been doing explainer videos for mostly tech products. So short animations that explain why you would want to buy a software or some new application. And so we just started brainstorming what could we do with that medium of short form animation that explains things well applied to the Bible. And I was really eager to do something with the Bible. I grew up with the Bible. Tim and I actually met studying the Bible in undergrad. And the Bible just kind of maintained this like this mystery to me. Also kind of this thorn in my side of like, I just, every time I'd come to it, I'd often leave a little frustrated, like I don't get it. And Tim was this friend of mine, still is a friend of mine, who I could just ask any Bible questions to. And his just kind of, he was so immersed in the Bible that he just had so much perspective that was beautiful. But then also just this humility that was wonderful. And then on top of that, Tim would always press me further of like, yes, you have questions, John, but let's ask the right questions and let's ask even more questions. And to me, there's just this freedom in our conversations that I just wanted to capture and continue to work on. And so that was the germ of the idea. We wanted to be able to give it away. So we decided to do it in a nonprofit entity and just ask people to pitch in. We made a couple pilots and said, if you want more of these, we'll make them once we have enough money to pay designers. And so people pitched in and then people got more generous and we were able to build a whole organization around it.
You two come from very different backgrounds. And Tim, can you tell us about how you became a believer?
Yeah, sure. I grew up in a religious family. My parents are Christians, but they both grew up in really strict religious homes. And so they wanted to create the exact opposite atmosphere. And so we attended church, but they really let my sister and I kind of make our decisions about whether we were going to accept or reject or do whatever with their Christian faith. And so they put a skateboard in my hands when I was 11, along with a subscription to Thrasher magazine, which I'm convinced they had never actually read, because if they had, I don't think they would have given it to their 11-year-old. But I didn't have negative associations with Jesus. Although after I got into skateboarding, it's what my parents represented. And so I was antagonistic with it, but not because I thought it through and didn't think following Jesus was reasonable or something. So, but it was actually through skateboarding years later in my teens that I was reintroduced to Jesus in language that I could understand. It was a skateboard outreach ministry in Portland. It was a church that built a skateboard park. And so I had been going to that for years, all through my teens. And they would just, every night at skate park, shares a story about Jesus or one of his teachings. And just over the years, that really buried itself deep in my mind and in my heart. And so I made a decision to start following Jesus when I was 20. But I had never read the Bible at any length. I didn't have positive or negative associations. It was all just brand new. And so, and that's where John and I met, was at that skateboard ministry, which was across the street from the college where we met. So that was kind of the context for our early relationship, was, you know, skateboarding, evangelism, urban culture in Portland, and, you know, Jesus. All those things go together just fine, don't they?
So, John, you seem like you have what I would call the investigative reporter gene. Am I right?
I would love to be an investigative reporter. That sounds like a good time. I listen to, like Fresh Air with Terry Gross, or On Being, and I just would dream of being able to have that kind of job where you just get to talk with really talented people who have these well-crafted views of the world and themselves, and just dig in and ask questions and try to figure it out. And so actually this project really scratches that itch in a unique way. It's not, I'm not a reporter or even a typical kind of journalist of any sort, but it is in that vein.
And Tim, you spent, a year in Israel before you started working in the ministry? What was that like, and what'd you get out of that?
Yeah, well, man, it was really neat. The graduate department of Jewish studies at University of Wisconsin, which is where I did my PhD, they had a partner relationship with the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. So I was able to go live there and do a year of school there, but, you know, work towards my degree at University of Wisconsin. And it was incredible. I was focusing on my research on the early origins of the Bible and manuscript history and the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so to go there and like see the artifacts, you know, and work in the text that way was a really unique privilege. But also to, you know, live there and not be on a tour bus, you know, like many visitors, but to be there through the seasons and walk about. And it was a formative experience in many ways. It's really hard to summarize a cross-cultural experience like that. And it did wonders for my Hebrew as well. So that was good.
When you were there, you were just mostly speaking Hebrew even, right?
Well, you know, actually in Jerusalem, it's an international city. And so the moment somebody can hear an accent in Hebrew that they think you speak English, they won't even talk to you in Hebrew anymore. They just talk to you in English. So what we had to do was actually travel outside of Jerusalem and get into areas where it was a little less urban. And there, lots of people didn't speak English. And so that did wonders for my Hebrew.
How many videos do you guys have right now? Does the Bible Project have?
I think it's around 150. Let's say that.
150. We do about 15 to 20 videos a year. And so we've been at it for 7 years. And I don't know if that math
computes. Where we put out like a ton.
Yes.
Like way
we
more.
We had the Blitz raid years. Yeah.
And I guess you never dreamed you would have that many videos when you started.
You know what? Tim did. When I came to this project with him, and then he came back to me with a spreadsheet of like 100 videos that he wanted to make. And he called it the Cosmic Map.
The 66 of them were the books of the Protestant Bible.
So yes.
You know, that's right. But the other, whatever, 44 were mostly theme videos. And
yeah.
Can you tell everyone the type of videos you have? I know you have like word study and stuff like that.
Yeah, the original idea was make a video that summarizes the literary design and the key ideas of every book of the Bible. So we've done that. but then we saw an opportunity to create a series on how to read the Bible, like helping people get introduced to the different parts of the Bible, different styles of writing and literature. So that is a whole series we did. We have an ongoing list of theme studies where we take an idea that's introduced in the first few pages of the Bible, and then that's developed throughout the story, coming to its fulfillment in Jesus. And then we do word studies. That was another idea. Usually these ideas happened over cups of coffee or a lunch walk, and we're like, you know what we ought to do. And so word studies is short, just studies on biblical vocabulary, strange words that we think we know what they mean, but if we tried to define them, we couldn't actually tell our friend what it means. And so there's a lot of words in the Bible, so that series could go on for a long time.
What do you I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, we started a new series as well called Visual Commentary. And that actually was an idea seeded by our friends at the YouVersion Bible app, who they host our book overview videos in their app. Actually, a lot of our videos in their app. And they came and they said, hey, did you ever thought about doing videos for chapters of the Bible? And we were like, huh, that's really interesting. And so this is kind of our version of that. It's not chapter by chapter, but it's kind of literary unit by literary unit. And we've got a couple of those out now.
Can you give us like an overview of, for example, what you would find if you were studying Psalms through the Bible Project?
Yeah, well, one, you know, Psalms is one of the larger books of the Old Testament. There's 150 poems. And many people read the book of Psalms the way they would read like a hymn book that they might find in a church, which is to skip around to your favorites and the ones that have the parts that you like the most. But the book actually is designed to be read from beginning to end. And so, and not only that, but the story underneath what's going on in the Psalms assumes that you've taken in the story that's being told in the other parts of the Bible, the stories of David and Adam and Eve and the temple and Solomon and so on, and the promise for the Messiah and the prophets. So the book of Psalms is a lot more like a symphony, but it's like the third movement of a symphony that's already been going for a long time. And it's working melodies and notes and instruments that you've already been hearing in other parts of the Bible, but just in new combinations.
So you make all of your resources free. Tell us how all of it gets funded.
Yeah, we've got a really large group of monthly supporters. It's been growing since the first day that we released some videos. We just told people very clearly, like, we want to make these, I mean, they're not free to make, but we want to give them away for free. And so really all we need is enough money to make it, and then it can be free. And people understand that, because this patronage model has kind of had a bit of a renaissance recently amongst creatives. And then people also get that they like to be generous to the church and to religious things. So I think that all just really gelled really easily, and people were like, awesome, we can get behind this. So we got people who are dedicated to doing that on a monthly basis because we're always putting out new content. And then we got people who just do that as they can. And we've always had enough. We've never been in a situation where there wasn't enough resources coming in, which is just wild. We just feel so incredibly honored and blessed to be able to work on this and to not have to put on the brakes.
One of the things, the crowdfunding kind of patronage idea was one of John's, most of what's good about the Bible Project is John's idea and at least many good things. And so the crowdfunding give away the content idea was really on John's heart, and he didn't have to persuade me that it was the right thing to do from the beginning. But one cool thing that we've observed is that when you're making media, oftentimes what you have to do is make marketing materials to help people know about the thing that you're creating so that they'll watch it or see it. And so the idea of making the videos the means of sharing it, the videos are the way it gets advertised. And so advertising is people sharing it.
Yeah.
Because they find it helpful. And there's something about that model that we've actually come to see as a huge gift, because if this thing is not meant to get off the ground, it won't, because no one will share it. And if it continues to be valuable to people, then people will share it. And then that's how we'll know that we're supposed to keep making stuff. So it also kind of gives a live feedback loop about our mission and what we're doing. And it kind of helps us keep our thumb on the pulse of what we're supposed to be doing.
Can you speak to the brevity of the videos and what was behind that decision?
Maybe my short attention span, possibly. So I had been working in this medium, and one of the constraints of this medium was brevity, partly because animation can get expensive, but partly because people's attention span on the internet is really short. And, but more so, it's that if you really understand something, you can actually explain it quicker. Mark Twain kind of famously said, I'm writing you a long letter because I didn't have time to make it short. There's this, making something short really forces you to understand what it is you're talking about as clearly as possible. And then you're, and so what we're interested in is helping people get the infrastructure of an idea. And then you can kind of fill that out as you need to and as you want to, but we're giving you the bones, and that doesn't have to be long. And it's much more shareable when it's short. And so all those reasons.
And I'm assuming it also affects the cost. What is the average cost of making a video?
Yeah, our videos span really wildly in cost, because most of the cost is in the design. It's in the paying designers to draw and to animate and those hours. And a video could be very simple. We have this style we call the doodle style, which doesn't take long to draw and it doesn't take long to animate. The Heaven and Earth video that we launched as one of our first videos is an example of that. And but then on the other end of the spectrum, we've done videos where we're hundreds and hundreds of hours of design. And so that really just adds up. So the average cost of a video, I maybe put somewhere around $30,000, but it could swing wildly.
And the scripting takes how long, do you think, to write it?
Yeah, you know, the scripting part, it really varies too. Sometimes what we find is when we're doing maybe just like one word or a book or a section of a biblical book, it comes together quicker, the writing process. Almost all the videos John and I co-write. Some, I'll write a draft and then John goes to work on it and we kind of hit it back and forth like a tennis ball. But, you know, it's not uncommon for us to get to draft 6 or 7 before we're done. Oftentimes when we're writing theme videos, it's kind of like trying to find one string of spaghetti amidst a whole bowl of spaghetti noodles, because the themes in the Bible aren't separate and nice. It's one multi-layered story going through. And so to pick out one, you have to be careful about it. And what happens is when you separate it out, you're kind of bending the biblical story out of shape, you know, to just take an idea like holiness or God's glory or the image of God, because they're all interconnected. But it is helpful to see each theme by itself. So sometimes the theme videos get even more drafts than that before we're done. But what's fun is that the writing process is itself a part of the learning process for John and I. And so then it just makes it really rewarding, however many versions of the script it takes before we get to the final product.
How many different languages was the Bible written in?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Three quarters of it, Old Testament, is written in ancient Hebrew. And then there is a couple sections of the Hebrew Bible that's written in ancient Aramaic, which was a cousin language to Hebrew. And then the New Testament was all written in a form of a Greek called Koine Greek, or common Greek. So three languages.
If a modern day Hebrew speaker was reading in the ancient Hebrew, would it be like us reading Shakespeare or something?
Yes, that's in fact, when I lived in Jerusalem, and when we first moved there, and I was really trying to up my game on modern Hebrew, it took a lot of work, because all I knew was 3,000-year-old Hebrew. And so our landlady, the woman that owned the apartment building that we were in, when I would go talk with her, she would always, in a kind way, but joke with me that I sound like Shakespeare. That's actually what she would say. She was like, you talk like Shakespeare. So that was funny. Again, that's often a clue that somebody in Israeli often knows to start talking English to somebody who starts talking in 3,000-year-old Hebrew, because they probably speak English.
Yeah, and Shakespeare's 500-year-old English. So imagine 3,000-year-old English.
Yeah.
Where exactly did the Bible come from?
That's a wonderful question.
You could take 3,000 years to answer that question.
No.
I won't do that. I promise I won't. The Bible comes to us from a small minority group within ancient Israel that, you know, began with, you know, there's all these stories, Noah and Abraham and so on, but the first person who ever is said to write anything down is Moses. So we're kind of late into the story by the time Moses starts writing. And then Moses, you know, began this covenant faithfulness group that was never very big in ancient Israel, right? Most of the Old Testament stories are about how the Israelites didn't actually want to be Israelites. And they wanted to follow all of these other gods except the one that rescued them. And so the Bible comes from this like small crew that stayed faithful to Yahweh and the covenant with him throughout history, Moses and the prophets and David and the poets. And so they're responsible for this long history of shaping of the Hebrew Bible that came into its final formation just a couple hundred years before Jesus was on the scene. And so Jesus and the apostles pick up the themes and the stories of those scriptures and claimed that they're carrying the story forward as a part of this faithful remnant that was gonna be a change agent for Israel so that Israel could be what God called it to be for all of the nations. And so that's how, you know, Jesus sending out the 12, go into all the nations. But it's a pretty small crew throughout history that's responsible for these remarkable texts that they believed and claimed were a partnership between themselves and the Spirit of God, so that what these texts are saying was also what God wanted to say to his people. That's not even to talk about ancient alphabets and the Dead Sea Scrolls and Greek. Well,
let's hear about the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Oh, they're awesome.
I mean, I know that there are some people who are like, well, the Bible, it's kind of like that children's game gossip. You know, you say one thing and then they whisper it to person to person, and at the end it's something totally different.
Yeah. Well, man, if that were true, that would be really unfortunate. That's a good thing. That doesn't describe what you actually see in the tradition and manuscript history at work. I mean, it's definitely not the case of like the final edition drops from heaven and is never changed in its manuscript history. It's a lot more involved and complicated than that. And there are a lot of variations throughout manuscript histories and so on. But the kind of variations and development that's going on has much more to do with how intensely these people were studying and memorizing these texts and trying to understand them so they could understand God's will. Usually if somebody's got a fantastic story to tell about how the Bible's been changed and adapted and you can't know what it is anymore, there's some marketing twist that's coming very soon. some book or some like class that you have to pay a lot of money for, or something. The actual history of the Bible is both more fascinating and a little more mundane.
Why are there so many translations of the Bible?
Well, to be honest, that has more to do with America and market capitalism than it does with much anything else. And I'm only joking a little bit. I mean, the most translations that exist in any language are in English. And a lot of it has to do with niche marketing and creating. We're a culture that has the money and resources to create more translations than any other culture in the history of the Bible. And so you can have translations aimed at certain demographics, and there's strengths and weaknesses, I think, to that, to be honest with you. But that's just kind of a reality of modern publishing and Bible translation.
So instead of using a specific translation when you're doing your work, you're probably just going straight from the ancient manuscripts, or do you use a translation?
Well, yeah, you know, I spent a lot of years developing fluency in these languages so that I could read the Bible in those languages. So that's what I do. What I do is consult, you know, modern translations and ancient ones a lot, because they come from brilliant scholars who worked really hard. And so for me, what all these translations represent is the hard work and the viewpoint of really, really smart people. And so I'd be silly not to pay attention to them.
Do you kind of have some go-to people? I mean, do you have like your group of people that you kind of go to?
Tim has a large posse of scholars that he consults.
Yes. I mean, in many ways, that's what all the books on my shelves are the people that I love to learn from. There are some scholars that I found very helpful and formative at different seasons of life, but the list just keeps getting longer because you discover new brilliant people. And so for Hebrew Bible, there's a handful of scholars, John Salehammer, whose little one volume Bible commentary I try and give out like candy. It's just called the NIV Compact Bible Commentary. And I literally, as I was learning to read the Bible in my first years as a Christian, I had that in my hand, and it's a very helpful resource. Christopher Wright is another Old Testament scholar who I've learned immense amounts from. Robert Alter, a Jewish scholar, Hebrew Bible. And for New Testament, some of my favorites are mostly British. Richard Baucom, N.T. Wright, or a female British scholar, Morna Hooker. These are some of my go-tos that I learned a lot from in my early years.
Do you know of any ancient historians who wrote about the Bible who were not Christians per se?
Mm-hmm. Josephus?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah. Josephus, he was an army. He was he's Jewish, who became a army official for the Romans decades after Jesus. And so he wrote a whole history of Israel, trying to explain everything to do with the Bible and Israel to your average Roman citizen. Well, not your average, but Romans who could read and write like he did, which is actually a pretty small group of people. there's a Jewish scholar named Philo, who lived around the same time, philosopher, Jewish. And then the people who produced the Dead Sea Scrolls were all priests and Bible scholars who thought the people running the temple in Jerusalem were so corrupt that they went down to the Dead Sea and just started their own alternate temple community down there. And lucky for us, they took their biblical manuscripts with them, but they wrote a lot of their own literature and poetry. There's a wealth of material for us to know about the context of Judaism in the Bible from the centuries before Jesus and around the time of Jesus. It's the coolest stuff in the world, I think. I make John learn about all of this stuff.
You don't make me, I mean.
It appeals to his investigative report.
He loves it, but I'd make him.
What do you think is the greatest misconception about the Bible?
The greatest misconception about Tim has talked a lot about maybe the top three misconceptions that we bring to what the Bible is, and it's something we've talked a lot about. And they're all paradigms we bring to the Bible they have good intentions, but then they kind of leave you a little wanting. One is that it is a rule book. there are a lot of laws in the Bible, but these are laws of ancient Israel that you'll find in the Torah, or you'll find commands that Jesus gives, and you find commands that Paul gives. But overall, the Bible isn't actually built as a law book or a rule book. Some people treat it as a book for systematic theology, like explain to me everything about the nature of God and humanity, and I can kind of create a system out of it. And it's not really a theology book in that way. Some people just think it's ancient, irrelevant, religious mumbo jumbo. But those are all misconceptions. The first two, I think, they have a good impulse to them. But ultimately, the Bible is a narrative, and it has tons of different types of literature in it. And it's telling a story about God and humanity. And it's a story that Jesus says that he's fulfilling. And so approaching it as a story and approaching all the literature on its own terms, whether that's narrative or poetry or apocalyptic literature or the letters that the apostles write, the Bible is a story that Jesus says that he's fulfilling. So coming to the Bible on those terms and wrestling through what does it mean that Jesus is the fulfillment of the story, that's the paradigm that we want to bring.
You know, it's interesting. My next question was, tell us about the different types of narrative in the Bible.
Just narrative or literature in general?
In general, literature in general.
Yeah. Oh, literature. Yeah, it's just some of it is easy to think about different books of the Bible. There's some that are telling narrative, so a linear set of events with a plot. So that's basically the first stretch of books of the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, on through the books of Kings and so on. But even embedded within those narratives will be big blocks of other types of literature. So poetry, you'll find often poems inset into narratives. For example, after the Exodus, and the people go through the sea with the walls of water on the right and left, and then it turns into a musical. The story stops, and it's just one big, the first praise song, and it's a poem. And then the story picks up again. And so, I don't know if you knew you're reading a musical when you're reading the Old Testament, but you are. So poetry, there's different types of poetry. There's song poetry, like represented in the book of Psalms. There are funeral songs represented by the book of Lamentations. It's like a funeral dirge using that style of poetry. There's proverbs, which are two or three line little sayings, super clever, often more like riddles. And then poetry was also the preferred mode of writing for the prophets. And then sometimes you have speeches that are what you might call prose discourse, like Moses on Mount Sinai giving his speeches. So those are the main big three buckets, narrative, poetry, and discourse. And they all have different ways of communicating. And, you know, discourse is aimed at communicating ideas and persuading you to do something about the ideas. But poetry is trying to communicate something, but it's also trying to make you feel something and engage you on a level of art and emotion, which is a totally different part of our mind and our brain. And narrative is more trying to form your view of reality by showing you patterns of how God is at work in history. And that's pretty different than like a speech, you know.
I would assume that you guys get a lot of questions. And I'm wondering, do you ever get questions from people asking about different things about their specific denomination?
You know, I'm sure we do. Tim probably gets more stuff in his inbox nowadays than I'm getting, but we've gotten to the size that we have a whole customer service crew now, like audience engagement crew. And most of the reoccurring questions Tim can speak into and kind of create a bit of a like a custom answer that they can reuse. If it is a tradition, if it's a specific question about a tradition, we usually just say we don't have time to address it. We might have some books to point people towards.
Yeah, for the most part, we, with the content we create, we're just trying to explore the main themes and ideas at work in the Bible. And we don't emphasize, or if there is a certain part of the Bible where there's really different interpretations, and that difference is the point of splitting for a denomination, for example, then sometimes we'll just say, like, here's what some people think, here's what the other people think. Regardless of what you think, here's what everybody agrees on, and then you move forward. Because what I find is a lot of people's energy, in fact, some people are only trained to ever read the Bible, looking for that stuff, focusing on those things. In other words, turning to the Bible to find out what I can believe about what my particular branch of Christianity believes. And so I think what we're interested in is a little something different. It's like, what's the common thing that everybody takes, you know, takes for granted or can agree upon? Because for me, that's where there's so much there. It actually gets less attention, I think, because it's maybe less exciting, but it's not less profound or important. And that's what we're having a really good time focusing on.
So in that way, that's how you're truly non-denominational.
Yeah, we really attempt to be. I've been surprised at the breadth of traditions that have been using the material. I grew up in the evangelical tradition. We have lots of Catholics even some Eastern Orthodox traditions using it, but then all sorts of Protestant traditions. So I've been so pleasantly surprised at how ecumenical this project has stayed. Part of that is, I think Tim has a bit of a genius of being able to figure out how to navigate those things so that when we come to a passage that could be divisive, instead everyone sees the thing that's the most important and everyone's like, oh yeah, I'm on board with that. And so everyone's nodding along. And then the next step they take might be a little different than someone else, but that's not what we're talking about. And so everyone kind of feels like, yes, this is for me. And that's been wonderful.
One of the most formative and fun classes I took at seminary was called Theological Systems. I know it doesn't sound exciting, but it was essentially, it was a huge stack of reading, but it was reading introductions or kind of the basic tenets of all of the different denominations. And I just learned so much. And it helped me realize that the best minds are in all of these different camps, and none of them have malicious will. Well, who knows? I don't know people's hearts, but I trust that actually they're giving their best of their mind and their heart to understand God's will from the scriptures and the Christian tradition, and they just genuinely disagree. And so knowing where and why the traditions disagree, and those things are often on a lower tier than the core of what we all agree on, for me, that was just enormously helpful to make those distinctions. And this project, I hope, is an embodiment of trying to hit at the core, help people gain the core.
John, I have to believe that making these videos is pretty different from the corporate work you did before. Is it more difficult?
Oh, no, actually, I don't think it would be. That's a great question. I don't think it is more difficult. I mean, technically, we're pushing ourselves harder technically and with like design, trying more difficult things than I ever did in the corporate world, just budget wise, really. Also, we don't have to deal with clients. It's actually really wonderful. The back and forth of the client can be a great refining process and help you get some really great work, but also it just slows things down and sometimes gets you worse work, honestly. And you just never know. It depends on the client. We are our own clients. Our crowd just trusts us in that. And so that actually makes it easier. And then there's just this passion for it. You know, there's just this, like, I've found it so mesmerizing and wonderful that it's just, I look forward to the discussions and look forward to the writing. And in the corporate world, you just never know. Like, sometimes you're interested, sometimes you're not.
Well, tell me about your team.
Yeah. Well, initially we were just an animation studio. So our team was illustrators and animators and storyboard artists and a producer. And then we needed someone to do the email. And we just kind of grew as an organization. And so now we've got kind of more typical roles as well, HR and structure. We've grown we have a team that just does localization now. We're in a couple dozen languages, and that keeps growing. And so we've got a team that just is working with language advisors and other studios to make that happen. We've got a team that's just focused now on just managing all our social channels. Tim, who am I missing? We have a big tech team. I mean, we've turned into a technology company. Because we've built our own website. We've built our own learning management system where we put classes on. Something we haven't talked about here, but Tim teaches full seminary level classes that we film and provide on our website. And we're gonna have more professors come in and do that. So we built that piece of technology from the ground up. We're building an app. So we've really become a tech company too. And so we've got that whole team.
I'm wondering about these classroom things that you're developing. And do you envision like one day being like an online seminary or something?
Seminary means different things to different people. if we're just talking about a place where people can come take deep dive courses into books on the Bible, pursue their questions about where the Bible came from, theological ideas in the Bible, then we want to build a big online library of classes that vary in length from 1 hour to 14 hours of content. All designed with learning exercises and experiences. One day, not too long, you could go through with a group of friends and go through the content together and interact, even if you don't live in the same place. That's the idea. And really, the passion was born very similar to the videos, but also a little bit different. Classroom environments about the Bible that are engaging it in depth often cost a lot of money. And they're limited to a very small audience of people who can pay the money and take the time to go to a place and do that. And so online education is in a revolution right now, but we just feel like the best of biblical studies shouldn't be available to such a small group. It should be available to anybody who wants to learn about it. And so that's our basic heart in the whole thing.
I know you guys are talking to me from your homes, but how else has the pandemic affected your work?
Yeah, everyone's working from home. And we found that actually been a great transition for us. It is harder to do creative work with others when you're not in the same room. It is harder. I think we're hitting a point where it's like, I can't wait for it to be over, but we're making it work. And in fact, it's worked so well in some regards that we're gonna allow a lot of people to just stay hybrid indefinitely. And we anticipated when the pandemic started that we would have to slow down, that giving would slow down, just the economy was slowing down. But that didn't happen. We just saw people continue to be generous, and we haven't had to slow down in that regard. So we're cruising.
I know that maybe some people in your organization look at the numbers every day, but I doubt that you guys do. But I'm just wondering if the numbers have increased of video views. How many views do you have of your videos right now? And have the questions that come in different? Are they different?
I mean, I know it's hundreds of thousands of views a day, but
that's right. 200,000 views a day on YouTube.
Yeah.
And then another 100,000 a day to 150,000 a day on the YouVersion app. They play our content. People also embed from kind of a Vimeo channel that we have that we get some views from. So we do have hundreds of millions of views. I don't know what it's at now.
How many YouTube subscribers do you have?
2.35 million right now. YouTube subscriber, that's super valuable, because you get like a notification that we got a new video. But at the same time, it's also a bit of a vanity metric. And it's hard to know how many of those people are actually like can engage with content or not.
The Bible Project provides free Sunday school materials. Do you know how many churches request or get that information per month?
I really have no idea.
We don't know.
And I don't even know if anyone here knows really. One of the things is that we could track how many people are downloading the video, but we don't know what they're doing with it. Are they playing it at church? Are they playing it at home? Are they downloading for themselves for a road trip? And then we hear from a lot of churches that are using it, and we hear from a lot of people who say, hey, my church is using it. But I have no idea how to answer that question. But a lot of churches. And most of our audience is right now on the West Coast. A majority, I would say the most people in California and Texas is kind of where most of our audience is. But it's also become global. On YouTube, nearly 50% of our views come outside of the United States. And then it becomes a bit of a black box to us beyond that, like how it's actually being used.
Lately, there's been a lot of, and I think you mentioned this type of thing earlier. There's been a lot of TV shows where they're taking ancient history about the Bible, and they're taking in ancient history and culture and politics a little more seriously. Have you seen any of those? And what do you think of them? Like, the one that I have in mind is there's this TV series called The Chosen. Have you seen that?
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
Have you watched it, Tim?
Yeah.
That's also, you know, this kind of crowdfunded project of sorts. It's a little different model, but same spirit. And yeah, I've only heard great things.
Soon you guys will be being able to cast from your app to the TV, right?
We already have some TV apps that you can use for our stuff. But when our app comes out, that'll be a real centralized place for our content for sure.
When you first started studying the Bible, what was the most surprising thing to you?
It's really hard to create a small list. So, you know, one would be like talking snakes and how God behaves, God's behavior, especially his violent behavior. These are portraits about God's behavior that have just captured my imagination, puzzled me, bothered me. But then also the way that Jesus both talks about the God of Israel and then claims to be, you know, the embodiment of the same God that's in the first three quarters of the Christian Bible. And that dynamic continues to just amaze me and be like a bottomless well of reflection for me on who the beautiful mind is that's behind this whole place that we're in. And the talking snake's a whopper. It's right there on page 3.
This question might take a minute for you to think of the answer, but is there one question you've never been asked that you wished you could answer?
One question that I've been asking, if I could reframe your question a little bit, because I don't have a good answer otherwise. But one question that I've been asking that I'm really interested in is how do you start reading the Bible from ground zero? Like, what's a good reading plan or reading rhythm, or what's the structure to coming to the Bible? You know nothing. Do you start reading Jesus' teachings? Do you start from the very beginning? A lot of people try to read the Bible in a year. Do you read it in a year? Is there like an optimized like reading experience to bring someone into the biblical story from zero and then get them all the way saturated to becoming a Bible nerd? I'm really interested in that question.
All right, so Tim, you get to answer the question.
You know, one Yeah, sure. One thing that I think about that would be a fascinating conversation is Jesus of Nazareth someone you would actually want to like hang out and spend time with? Because there are some days where I would want to spend the rest of eternity with him. And then there's another part of me that thinks, but he would never answer any question I have. He would just ask another question back to me.
He'd give you a riddle.
And that might get old after a while. But maybe at some point he would try a different tactic. And he would just want to like hang out and have a lemonade and sit by the lake or something. I don't know. Anyway. But often I wonder, is Jesus somebody who you would actually want to spend an afternoon with, or would it be too difficult and soul piercing?
So, wow, that's a wonderful meditation.
Tim, how would you answer John's question? Where do you send somebody who wants to start reading the Bible or knowing about the Bible? Where do they go first?
You know, there are advantages and disadvantages to starting at page one. Starting at page one, obviously it's the beginning of the story. The trick is that it begins a narrative that's told in ancient Israelite narrative style, you know, written originally in another language from another, on the other side of the planet for most people. And so there are obstacles there for comprehension, just starting it from the beginning. So another strategy is to just start with the stories of Jesus. The Gospel of Luke and Acts were written as a two-volume work that get you all the way from Jesus. And Luke begins actually with some backstory to help you understand who Jesus is and why he comes onto the scene, all the way up to the spread of the Jesus movement out into the nations. And so I think Luke Acts is actually a good place to start for some people. And also because in Luke Acts, they're constantly quoting from the first three quarters of the Bible, the Old Testament. And so you don't have to read very long before you realize like, oh, to really get this on the next level, I need to understand all the rest of the Bible. And I find helping people do things in that order can be pretty helpful, pretty good place to start.
Tell me about Church at Home. Was that born before the pandemic or Prevenient Grace? I mean, or did it come up afterwards?
Yeah, it was a response to the pandemic. We saw that the church was scrambling to figure out what to do in March. There was so many unknowns. And there's some churches that are large and media savvy, and they just quickly switched to online. There were other churches that just couldn't. And there were people just kind of stuck at home on Sundays, and they didn't know what to do. So we thought, what a cool opportunity to use our library, pick a video, give a meditation, reflection on some scripture related to the video. We thought this isn't a huge lift for us, and it meets a need in that moment. And so we called it Church at Home because the church was forced to be at home at that moment in our lives. Now we're in a slightly different season, this kind of in between. Depending on where you live, whether or not you could attend church or not, or if your church has figured out how to stream its service or whatever you're doing. So, but we found so much traction with the Church at Home, so many people using it, that we're going to continue it. We're not going to call it Church at Home because we're not trying to compete with church. We're not trying to be a church. It's just a weekly Bible study that will continue. And actually, starting in January, the weekly Bible study is going to follow a one-year reading plan. It's a reading plan that you can find on YouVersion, the Bible app. You could also find it on our website. It's called One Story That Leads to Jesus. You read through the whole Bible in a year, mostly in order. And you use our videos while you read through the Bible in a year. And then the weekly study we'll take a passage from that week's reading and we'll meditate on it. And then you can use that for yourself personally or with a small group or in a church. And that'll continue through 2021. And then we're also gonna release a new podcast, a small like 10-minute podcast with that week's reflection and some discussion questions that goes along with it as well. And so that's all coming in 21. So if you wanna read the Bible with us next year, you could sign up for the weekly email It's just called The Bible Study on our website. And also, if you're a podcaster or you listen to podcasts, we're going to have a new podcast called Reflections that will also bring you along in that.
Well, you answered my last questions. What's coming in 2021? So I just want to thank you guys for doing this. It means a lot. And I know our listeners are going to love it.
Great. Well, thanks for having us. Yeah,
it's great to talk with you. Happy to talk to you.
Thank you for joining us for Illuminations. Tune in next time for another interesting guest and another interesting story.
The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Red River Radio, our staff or advisory board, or of LSUS. Comments and suggestions may be addressed at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. This program, copyright 2020.